September the 7th, 1960, Fairbanks, Alaska. And this is Pioneer Eagle 4 tape recording of Earl Pilgrim and his early life when he came into Alaska.
Oh, back then, yeah. Well, this is Earl Pilgrim speaking, and I was born in Durango, Colorado, September 11, 1892. Durango was a wild and woolly cattle and mining town in southwest Colorado. And the boys didn't carry guns anymore in town, but they had them stashed up in their living quarters and used them whenever they got in a good argument. When I was my last year in grammar school, we left Durango and spent about 1 year in Minneapolis. My father was a steam engineer and had been an engineer in a big smelter in Colorado and had sold some mining property to the Union Pacific Railroad. So we had a little money and went back to Minneapolis and lived there about a year. Then we moved to Seattle, Washington, where I finished my education, my high school, and university. I attended the University of Washington in the College of Mines and received a degree of mining engineer in 1916. I first came to Alaska in June of 1915 and worked in the famous Alaska Treadwell gold mines, 2,000 feet deep and under the ocean. I worked there as a mucker and as a machine man. And then I went back to school again in October of that year and graduated in the spring of 1916. I mined in Idaho, British Columbia, Nevada, California, and before coming to Alaska again. In the meantime, I spent about a year and a half with Uncle Sam's military forces. I enlisted in the 27th Mining Regiment of Engineers, the only mining regiment in the U.S. Army, in which there were a few Alaskans and men from all other mining districts in the whole United States and other countries. I served with them as a private and was later sent to Engineer Officer Training School, where I received a commission as Second Lieutenant Engineers. And then at the end of the war, I went back to mining again, but I left. My last job in the States was superintendent of a little zinc oxide smelter near Los Angeles. I left there to come to Alaska with the Alaska Agricultural College and School of Mines as professor of mining engineering and metallurgy. This school, which later now is the University of Alaska. I was with the institution for 4 years, but left in the spring of 1926 to go mining for myself, and I have been operating in Alaska and practicing consulting work ever since. At presently, I own the Stampede mine, which is the second largest antimony mine in the United States of production. This mine is located in the Kantishna district, about 110 miles southwest of Fairbanks. And I have been interested in this property since 1937. And when I first arrived at the college, as we called it, I was sure disappointed by the looks of the place. We had one, there was one building there, which later was called the administration building and was demolished only very recently to make, after this new Bunnell building was established. At that time, just the center part of the building had been erected, and one residence, which was called for the president of the university to live in, and no other buildings. The power plant in the building was a little 5-kilowatt direct current steam generator taken off of some riverboat, 110 volts. This plant gave trouble, and we were cramped for room, even though we only had a few students at the beginning. However, we managed to get through, and at the end of the first year, I drew the plans for a wing to be built onto that building. And then 2 years later, another wing was built onto the other end of it, making a sort of an H shape. There were six teachers at the beginning of the university and 5 students. But when I left in 1926, it had grown considerable in enrollment and somewhat in instructors. There were several more instructors. Dr. Patty, who was later became president of the university, arrived there at the same time that I did. Some of the real pioneers of interior Alaska were still in and around Fairbanks, and I met these men and knew them quite well. Tom Aiken, who was famous, having mined in Colorado, and then in the Klondike, and then in Alaska, operated a dredge at Candle, and finally sold out his interest and retired to the States. Frank Manley, another rough and ready pioneer who was famous in the same era of the Klondike and Fairbanks. And Tom Gilmore, after whom Gilmore Creek is named, I knew him quite well. I knew, I can't think his name now, the man that discovered Mastodon Creek in the 40 Mile. And there are a great many of those who I would consider, and always did, real pioneers. They were still here. Eric Berman, I knew him quite well. He told me that he was prospecting down the Chattanooga Valley, or he didn't know the name of the creek. It was unnamed then. And he must have been quite close to the mouth of Clary Creek when he met some fella who told him that the news that gold had been discovered on the beaches of Nome. So Eric turned around and headed for Circle and the Yukon to get down to Nome. He also was one of the stakers in Nome whose claims were jumped by the gang that tried to take over Nome and many of the rich claims, and did take over them. Eric said that he never did get his claim back. Then later on, not later, but at about the same time, I got to know Ben Eielson. Ben Eielson came up to Fairbanks the same fall that I did, and taught in a Fairbanks High School, taught history. And at first we didn't know about Ben, how he was a famous flyer before he ever came up here. That he had won the Harmon Trophy, I believe, and he, after being a World War I flyer, he had barnstormed around, and like a lot of lost souls, he didn't know exactly what to do, but he finally got to thinking about the benefit of that Alaska was the ideal place to for flying to develop, because they had to have something like that for progress. So he got a job teaching in Fairbanks, and he came up here very quietly, like Ben always was. And after he'd been here, he started talking to a few men and got enough people interested to buy this World War surplus plane and ship it up here for him to make the first Pioneer flights around Fairbanks. And later he became real famous for all the exploits of flying over the Arctic and in the Antarctic, and with Cap Wilkins, Sir Hubert Wilkins. And then Ben, of course, was, as you all know, was killed in a crash over on the Siberian coast. I had heard of a big deposit of antimony over in the Kantishna from various sources, and Bill Taylor, one of the three men to climb Mount McKinley, was a good friend of mine, and I knew Bill had was one of the owners of this property. So and the National Lead Company, Mr. Morris P. Kirk of the National Lead Company, was an old friend of mine. I had worked with him and for him and in the States. So I, by through correspondence, I got them to interested in this antimony property. So I flew into Quigley's landing field in the Kantishna in 1936 in the fall, and got a hold of Bill. He was staying with Joe Quigley, one of the discoverers of gold in the Kantishna, up at his mine. So I got an option from Bill. And then I got the option of Jake Howell's interest, and an option of Charlie Trundy, who were other owners in this property, and turned the options over to the National Lead Company. Bill Taylor and I wanted to see the commissioner's book and check over the location, so Bill Taylor and I carried the books. After we examined, we carried them, the Kantishna mining books, 14 miles from Trundy's cabin. Trundy had frozen his feet the winter before, and so was in a veterans hospital in Portland, Oregon. And Bill and I carried these 300 pounds of books 14 miles and brought them up to the McKinley Park Highway, and then brought them to Fairbanks, where they still repose. Now all the Kantishna district is recorded through Fairbanks Recording District. I knew practically all of the first pioneer pilots in Alaska. Noel Wien, I remember when he came into the country as a young rosy-cheeked pilot in 1924, I believe. I knew Bill Shannon, one of the famous dog mushers, knew him quite well. He carried part of the serum, diphtheria serum, to Nome on the same time that Sepala worked on the other end of it, and Maggie Smoke, a native woman, carried one stretch baloney nana of the serum. I guess we were American Legion, but it, one incident about involving Ben Ileson and Cap Wilkins. He was a World War I captain. He had the title before, after he flew over the pole. He was knighted because he was a British subject and became Sir Hubert Wilkins. But this incident on the flight in which they were leaving Fairbanks to go to Barrow and then attempt to fly over the pole to Europe, I spoke to Ben about asking him if he would carry the American Legion flag with him. Ben says, sure, but you better speak to Cap about it first. So I asked Cap if he could take this American Legion flag on this little plane. It wasn't a very large plane, a single-engine plane, Lockheed Vega. Nice little plane, though. Cap said, yes, but make it quite small. So I took my armband, American Legion armband, and took the Legion symbol, gold and blue, a woven symbol off, and I had to Mrs. Janser, who had a tailor shop on Cushman Street. She was a pioneer. Last time I saw her was on Market Street, San Francisco, walking along several years later. But I took it to her, and she cut the symbol out and fitted it on some blue, dark blue silk, a square, about 12 inches or more square. And then she sewed a gold fringe around it, about a 2-inch fringe all the way around it, made a very pretty little square flag. Then we had the ceremonies out at the field. This newspaper man, Earl Rossman, took picture movies and other pictures of me presenting this little flag to them, and a bunch of American Legion boys with their hats, caps. And Ben took this and flew it over the pole to Spitsbergen, and then it reached Norway, and Cap was made a Sir, knighted, and Ben was given, I forget what, his medal, and then the governor of North Dakota made Ben a colonel. And these pictures, the funny thing about these pictures was that they were published in the papers in the States, in the Rotogravure section, showing us, presenting these pictures to Ben. But Ben said that in the Paris pictures, after they arrived in Paris, the Frenchmen, apparently they didn't like a bunch of our smooth-shaven Legionnaire veterans. We said they had whiskers. So Ben said they had mustaches and whiskers sketched onto all of our pictures in the Rotogravure section. And he had brought them back and had them in North Dakota. And he was intended to bring them up and show them to me. But he was killed before he got the opportunity to. So I never saw them. Coming back to the Kantishna, my first trip into the Kantishna district was in 1923. I'd heard about the Kantishna district, and the Kennecott Copper Company was doing some prospecting at Copper Mountain or Mount Eielson in McKinley National Park, and it hadn't been a park too long. So I bought a pack horse, and with my wife accompanying me, we traveled in there. There were no roads through the park then, and we took our time and made a nice journey. I knew how to pack a cayuse. I'd learned that when I was a kid in Colorado. So that part was easy. A lot of people like Judge Bunnell, the president of the university, warned me that it was a terrible country to get out in the wilds, and that the bears were so plentiful that they'd eat me up sure as sin. And John Davis of the Bureau of Mines told me it was just lousy with grizzly bears, and it's terrible to attempt to go through. But nevertheless, my wife and I made it fine and dandy, and we didn't. I had my old Springfield with me, but we didn't see but one or two distant bears, and we had a lot of fun too. And we got into Kantishna, and I had met Joe Quigley, one of the discoverers of the Kantishna district, an old Klondiker who had come in there, and also Fanny Quigley, who was also lived in the Klondike. I believe she was a dance hall girl before she necked her sled all the way from the Klondike to Nome in the Nome Stampede, down on the ice, followed the Yukon down and to Nalato and across to the coast and on up. But I met them on a, we met them on the way in this time. They were mushing out to the railroad, going to make a trip stateside. And when we passed them on the trail, Joe, big, tall, angular guy with a rifle on his shoulder and a pack, small pack, and short, stocky fanny with a great big pack, looked like about the size of a bushel basket, and leading three dogs. And they were going to the railroad. Then when we got farther down to Eureka Creek, there was a man named Fink. Hamilton and Fink were the mining there, placer mining, on Moose Creek at the mouth of Eureka, and we stayed with them a day or so. And Joe Dalton, another discoverer of gold in the Kantishna, about the same time that Joe Quigley did, and they both located, they met each other the same day. They had one coming up Eureka and one going down Eureka Creek. And they didn't know that each other was in the country at the time, but they had both found what they thought was pay on Eureka Creek. And they remained there a long time. Joe Dalton was a cousin, I believe, of Dalton of the Dalton Trail, famous dog. Dalton had claims there, both load and placer claims in the Kantishna. And I met a number of other pioneers who were still in there at that time and mining. Johnny Boucher was a relatively newcomer. His father, I believe, had been in, or uncle, had come in there earlier, and he died, and Johnny lived a long time until just recently. He died a couple of years ago in the Kantishna. Bill Julian was in there at that time, and I don't remember all the rest of them, but that was my first trip into the Kantishna, and a very pleasant one. Then I made a number of trips in there later before I started working at Stampede, took this option on the Stampede property. The first winter at Stampede, we, without even a compressor, we mined and sacked and hauled about 900 tons of high-grade antimony ore and put us on the statistics as the having produced more antimony than any other mine in the United States the very first winter, without even having had a compressor until this, most of this ore was shipped. We'd gone in there and arrived there just in the middle of December and started taking out ore and produced more ore than any other mine in the United States, antimony ore, that is. And from then on, Stampede has been a producer off and on until now. We've been shut down for about 3 years because of the market being flooded with foreign ores and the fact that we still haven't received, haven't obtained a truck road to truck our ores. Right at present, we have received authorization from the state of Alaska for to go ahead and build a Pioneer access road from the mine to the railroad, which will be a little over 50 miles. We have to build this with our own equipment, and the state will reimburse us to a certain extent, which means that we will get quite a bit of the work done with the state funds, but we'll probably be out a few thousand dollars of our own in doing it. But we will have a road and expect to have it within 2 years now. And from then on, people will probably hear more about Stampede antimony than they have in the past. When I started work at Stampede, I'd been in there with horses first. I took in some National Ed Company men and took them down through park with pack horses, and they didn't believe it would be possible to get any ore out of there, but anyway, they authorized me to try and get some out and to get 300 tons, and we ended up by shipping nearly 900 tons that winter. But and we have shipped up to date to between 3,500 tons and 4,000 tons of ore and concentrates. We've shipped most of that, hauled it to the railroad with tractors and sleds, but we have flown about 350 tons from a runway which we built at the mine, or at about 2 miles from the mine on Clearwater Valley. This runway is 4,300 feet long, and the pilots say it's about the best private runway that they know of in Alaska. We built it with our own equipment, and we didn't get much help from the government or the state either. This old dog that I took with me, he's a Siberian Husky and sure was a smart son of a gun. When I first started work there in October 1936, Lon Brennan flew me in and landed me on the Toklad River. First, we dropped everything that we could about 2 miles from the mine, and then landed on the river bar down about 6 or 7 miles. And I started with a pack of 66 pounds and made it up. I also discovered when we landed that I somehow or other we'd left my rifle in Fairbanks. And so for 2 days, 3 days, I was without a rifle, but I had to carry a load from this place on the Toklad up to the mine. Nobody there, of course, the mine was vacant, and then go back down to where we dropped this stuff about 2 miles away and make a trip with the bacon and ham and butter and things that a bear or a wolverine might get, and then made another round trip to get my sleeping bag the first day, and the second day I made a trip clear down to the Toklad for another load of stuff, and then back up to camp, and then one more trip down to where I dropped this stuff and back to camp. And I was a pretty busy boy there for those 3 days. Then on the third day, Brennan came in with two young fellows to work with me and the old dog and my rifle. I believe the rifle and the dog were the most important things. I was sure glad to have them because there are quite a few grizzlies in that country. Anyway, we started in and cut timbers and peeled timbers, and then after a few days I started out and hiked to the railroad, and that was in October, and it was getting pretty cold the latter part of October, and I waded all the rivers and reached the railroad and went up to Fairbanks and arranged to fly in a plane load of grub, which we flew in, I think, on late in October, and dropped it all because we couldn't land. This river was slushing up, so that the, and there was a little snow on the bar, and the pilot was afraid his brakes wouldn't hold on trying to land on this short space. So we had to drop everything and then go back to Fairbanks, and I arranged to go in there with a tractor and sleds. And that took a little time, and we left lignite with a little 40 diesel cat and two sleds loaded with supplies. The dog and these two boys were over at the mine. We reached Savage River and waded that river okay on Thanksgiving Day. And then we got to Teklanika, or Middle River, and the river was too deep and swift and full of ice to possibly cross it. So we spent over 2 weeks, pretty near 3 weeks, before we managed to get across that river. And once we tried it and broke in and had a dickens of a time getting out, but we finally got out, and I just had to wait and keep building up splashing water on top of brush and timber until we got thick enough ice to cross, and get over and be on our way. The day we crossed, it must have been 40 below because it was, you could tell by the exhaust of the diesel engine and other condition, it was pretty cold. And we got to Shoshana River, and here we met the dog coming out. And I was glad to see the dog, and the dog was glad to see us, apparently, and we wondered what had happened to the two boys that we'd left at the mine, and finally here they came along. And it seemed they were just following the dog. They had been 6 days on their way, and they had thought they were about to the railroad, but actually they were still 25 miles from the railroad and out of food, and it was plenty cold. And I imagine if the dog had run into us and those boys, that they would never have made it. So they just got lonesome and thought they were getting kind of low in food. But we turned around and took them on with it back to the mine with us and kept on working that winter. This same dog, another time, he went away with a big she-wolf and was gone with her 9 days. And I saw him chasing around with her. He was a Siberian husky and much smaller than this wolf, but he apparently mated with her because they were gone for 9 days. And this same dog, another time, he was with the men freighting the cat outfit, and they got lost in a storm. And one fellow was out trying to find the tripods, markers that we had along the trail, and he said he finally got bewildered and didn't know where the dickens the sleds were and the tractor, and he was just lost. And he says, out of the storm here showed the old dog, Kobuk, and he got down on his knees and hugged the dog. He was so glad to see him, and he told him to take him back to the sled. The dog started out, and he just followed him, and pretty soon he was back to the sleds.
This is the end of the second half of this reel of Pioneer Igloo 4 tape recording of the life of Earl Pilgrim, teacher, miner, prospector, Cantation area of Alaska. And we'll transfer to another reel for some more stories.